This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In just a couple of days, Governor Peter Shumlin will head to China and Vietnam for a trip designed to drum up support for the Northeast Kingdom Development Project. Shumlin's way is being paid for by Jay Peak. The resort's owner, Bill Stenger, is also going on the trip, along with Commerce Secretary Lawrence Miller and others from state government and from Jay Peak. The main focus is on potential investors who are lured by the EB-5 visa, allowing them residency in the United States in exchange for $500,000 in investment. Bill Stenger says one of the biggest reasons potential investors are interested actually has more to do with family than business.
For many, many people who invest in this program, they do so to be supportive of their children who may already be in this country in college or university, and who may wish to live and work here after they graduate.
Spouses and dependents of the foreign investor are granted green cards, too, so the appeal is varied. Bill Stenger will also be talking up the investment potential in the 10-day trip, and Shumlin and Miller will be singing the praises of Vermont. But Governor Shumlin will have more than just Vermont's good side on his mind. There are a lot of thorny issues affecting the state's economic picture, and the governor has a role in many of them. Today on the program, we're going to spend the hour with Governor Shumlin looking at the purpose of this trip, looming health care changes, and what he can do to ease the pain of the shutdown of Vermont Yankee for Vernon and surrounding communities. Listeners, if you have a question for him on any of these or other issues, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your questions at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Governor Shumlin, nice to have you with us today.
Hey, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Let's spend just a couple of minutes here on this trip, since that's the next big thing on your agenda. Do you know who you're going to be talking to on this trip specifically?
I don't, but this is what I've done. As you know, this project could produce 10,000 jobs in the kingdom. And
although Bill Stenger has now said probably 2,500 to 3,000 in the kingdom.
Well, the number is dependent upon whether you're talking about permanent jobs or associated jobs that come with it. During construction, obviously, the number is much higher. But whatever the number is, it's thousands and thousands of jobs. And the exciting thing about this particular project, is that it's obviously happening in the area of the state where we've had chronically the highest unemployment. And most kingdom kids, you know, have to leave the kingdom to make a living. And it's just it's a tough situation. So in my goal to make sure that we're creating jobs, not just in Chittenden County, because frankly, Chittenden County, its engine keeps booming with or without the help of state government, within reason. We've got to get jobs in other parts of the state. So what I said to Bill and to the team is, listen, I want to see this project happen. I can't go and speak about the particular project because SEC rules wouldn't allow a governor to do that, thankfully.
They do allow you to the trip to be funded by the developer of that project?
Well, they don't care who funds the trip. Okay. What the SEC cares about, and for good reason, is obviously I'm not into the finances of any particular EB-5 project, and therefore I can't be an advocate for the finances, nor would I want to be. What I want to talk about is why Vermont's such a great place to invest in jobs and economic development, and it is. We've got a great story to tell. So I said to Bill and the team, listen, I will do whatever it takes. And they said, what we really need is for you to go on a road with us because it gives credibility when a governor shows up and talks about their state. I'm taking my secretary with me along with others from the team. And really, our job is going to be to talk about Vermont and why it's a great place to grow jobs and economic opportunities.
Why is it so important for you to go specifically? I mean, if you're going to be going to various places, talking to investors and talking to advisors in China, I don't mean this rudely, but are they going to know who you are? I mean, does it matter that they're speaking to the governor of Vermont?
Believe it or not, it does. And, you know, as I talk to my other governors who do a lot of, digging for gold in Asia, whether they're trying to bring jobs in or whether they're trying to export product. In Asia, you have to understand that obviously in China, Vietnam, both countries I'll be in, power is government. In other words, if you have a government position in those countries, you have real clout and real power. So when someone shows up from another government, that's actually probably the most important ingredient for them in understanding that they're talking about something that's real and that they're not just being deceived.
So what would look like success to you out of this trip? Bill Stenger says he's hoping to get another 100 to 200 investors out of this trip. If you're looking at more than just the Northeast Kingdom Development Project, are there other benchmarks for success for you?
The success for me will be in proof is in the pudding. And as you know, it's a very ambitious project. We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. Don't forget, for every 100 million, you got to go find 100 investors. 200 investors. Right. So obviously, we need to talk to lots of people. What I've said to them is, listen, book me solid, book me hard. I'm not someone who likes to sit around. I'll give you 7 days of my life in Asia. You put me anywhere you need to, and keep me busy. And that's exactly what they're going to do. So we'll be just frankly sitting in hotels and meeting rooms talking to EB5 investors. I'll be talking about Vermont. They'll be talking about their projects. If we come back with investors that are going to help us grow jobs in the kingdom, I'll say mission accomplished.
And you don't have any specifics for needing to get EB5 investors elsewhere in the state. It really is about the Northeast Kingdom at this point.
This trip is exclusively for this project. And let's go to the question of the payment that you raised. When I came in as governor, I was concerned that when governors and, whether on a bipartisan basis, along with the congressional delegation, we all support this program because, Vermont harnesses about 20% of all the EB5 dollars in America, our teeny little state. We're doing this right. We're the only statewide EB5 program in the country. Senator Leahy has been extraordinarily helpful in helping to make all this happen, and Senator Sanders and Congressman Welch are very supportive. But here's the point. When I came in, I felt a little uncomfortable as I made EB5 trips, which I was doing then for particular projects, let's say traveling with people who are advocating for particular projects that were also entrepreneurial, obviously. They're not doing this to lose money. I felt a little uncomfortable with taxpayers paying the bill. And I thought to myself, obviously we're growing jobs. There's a huge benefit to Vermonters. But in this case, there's also a huge benefit when a governor shows up to whoever's promoting the project.
Mm-hmm.
So I had the legislature in my first year change the statute so that when we get an investor in Vermont in an EB5 program, some small percentage of that $500,000 goes towards the state's costs for promoting the EB5 program statewide. What that means is that instead of taxpayers paying the bill for my trip, which is what would have happened under previous governors, and for Lawrence Miller's trip, the secretary, and all the others, that the investors end up paying. So the way it works is Jay Peake pays the bill for all of state government's efforts on this behalf, including mine. But when they get investors, eventually that is repaid to the fund. So the money is really ultimately coming out of the people who invest the $500,000 for the green card.
Got it. And just so we're absolutely clear, Jay Peake is paying for your trip and for Lawrence Miller's trip. It is not paying for your security detail. The state pays that.
I would assume so. The state pays for my security no matter where I go. As you probably know, if I go visit my mom, they're with me. So that's just part of being governor.
We're talking today with Governor Peter Shumlin. We've been talking about his upcoming trip to China and Vietnam. Going to touch on a lot of issues today. And listeners, if you have questions, you can share them by posting at vpr.net. Just click on Vermont Edition or call 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to Ellen calling in from Walden. Hi, Ellen. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for this opportunity to ask you a question, Governor. My question is actually about health insurance, health care. I used to live in New Hampshire and still have a lot of friends there, and I've heard them talk about what's happening with health insurance over there and their health insurance exchange. And I was just wondering if you could talk about why our health insurance exchange is different from their exchange and sort of what's going on.
Sure. Thanks for calling, Ellen. The Affordable Care Act gave governors two choices. One was to build your own exchange in-house in the state with federal resources. The other was to have the feds come in and do it for you. New Hampshire's been a little bit, I would argue, in the weeds on how to respond. The Tea Party or the more conservative elements of the Republican Party took over their legislature in the election before this last one. So you had Governor Lynch with a pretty conservative, suddenly, Senate and House. And he was unable to get the kind of support for a state-sanctioned and implemented exchange that we were able to get in Vermont. So really the difference is that New Hampshire is, I would argue, behind us. Those low-income and middle-income people who are struggling to pay for health insurance are going to have trouble doing it on their exchange. In Vermont, we really embraced it. And I'm really proud of that choice. What we decided in Vermont was that we were better doing it the Vermont way, using the federal resources, but making sure that we had control of it. And we wanted to ensure that we drew down as many federal resources as we could that came with the Affordable Care Act. So we said, hey, let's be the only state that says this website. Vermont Health Connect is going to be where you're going to purchase health insurance if you have 50 employees or less, and eventually it'll bring all employees in 100 and up. And we want to draw down we think we're going to get up to $400 million of federal subsidies to help Vermonters pay for health insurance that they're currently struggling to pay for. So really, it's a one-stop shopping. It's very clear. There's over 20 plans that are offered in Vermont Health Connect. The good news is that the benefits are all the same, so you no longer have to read the fine print and figure out whether you have maternity coverage, whether you have, hospitalization covered. It's all uniform benefits, and then you get to choose, of the 20 plans, how much copay basically you want to pay, how much risk you want to take as you purchase that insurance. Then it matches your income with the federal subsidies. $94,000 or less for a family of four. I believe it's $46,000 for individuals. You will get some federal subsidy to help you pay for health insurance, whether you're an employer or an employee. So that's the good news.
Where's the bad news then?
The bad news is that New Hampshire's behind us, and I feel sorry for them, frankly, because you're going to have, really lots of folks who are struggling to pay for health insurance that aren't going to have the kind of access to the federal system that we will immediately have on January 1st here in Vermont.
Some people who currently have insurance through their employers are saying the bad news is sitting with them, that they're actually, because they can't keep their current health care insurance, they're coming out as losers. They're going to have to pay more for insurance, maybe get less. They're paying perhaps more in premiums, but often looking at higher out-of-pocket costs. Why are they not losers?
The vast majority of people who buy insurance in Vermont or the federal exchange are going to be winners, for the simple reason that when you draw down $400 million in federal funds to pay for what you're already paying for right now, it's obviously going to help us. So there's no question that where you get into the losers in Vermont is that a small percentage of people who were getting help through Catamount and other plans to help pay for your struggling health insurance will find that the federal system is less generous than we were being to some categories of income holders. So there's no question that those people were concerned about. We've tried to help. We have helped fill the gap there somewhat with last year's budget. But the vast majority of Vermonters will be winners with the federal exchange, and I think that they'll realize that once they start to use it.
It doesn't look, though, I'm going to use myself here for one quick example. It doesn't look, though, like there's any plan in which I can pay the same that I'm currently paying for a premium and not have to pay more out of pocket if I get sick.
That's
not a Catamount thing. That's about not being able to have the same kind of insurance that you have currently in your small business as what you're going to be able to have on the exchange. Some people are questioning, why can't I keep my exchange? Why can't I keep my insurance? I thought that's what President Obama said. If you like your insurance, you can keep it.
Well, I would disagree with your assessment a little bit. I'd love to see why you think that's the case when you go on the exchange. Unless you have something very unusual right now, you're basically getting the same product. I mean, it's MVP and Blue Cross Blue Shield. That's what we're all buying right now. And you will find, I believe, that those rates are similar to what you were buying before this year. Now, I'd love to look at – we can get a navigator to work with you on your particular case. But in most cases, that you're going to find – Vermonters will find that there's not much change. Now, why is that? That's because we're doing so well already in Vermont. I mean, we aren't Tennessee. We're not Alabama, where they have very high uninsured rates. We're not a state where we allow cherry picking, where insurance companies can come in. We got rid of that under Governor Snelling, years and years ago, where insurance come in, pick the healthy people and tell everybody else they're not going to cover them. So the financial difference to Vermont isn't as extreme as you would find in other states where they were doing really terrible things in the insurance industry. We got rid of those things a long time ago. Having said that, when you start drawing down $400 million of federal money in this little state, there's going to be more winners than losers.
We got a note from Lori who wants to know, why is it mandatory only for small businesses to join the insurance exchange? Vermont employees don't have to use the exchange. I think she means state employees. What happened to freedom of choice? This is killing small business in Vermont, she says.
You know, you have the same choice now that you had under the old system. It's really true. The difference is that you can go to one central website now to see all of your options, and the federal government has required that certain benefit levels be met, that you can't say in a policy, hey, if you go to the hospital, you're on your own. If you got pregnant, you're on your own. If you have a pre-existing condition, sorry, you're on your own. So really, when you look at the advances that they've made there by saying uniform plans, you can't cherry pick in terms of the benefits you get once you pay, and the fact that we're getting these federal drawdowns, I think, as I mentioned, most Vermonters will find that their choice has not been diminished and they're going to be in better financial shape than they were before. Now, I don't want to pretend to you that the exchange is perfect. It's not. President Obama has told me and other governors, listen, this is a starting point. We're expecting states to be the laboratory for change to make this better. That's exactly what we're doing in Vermont. This is an interim step to where we need to go. What the Affordable Care Act doesn't do is contain cost. And if we keep spending money like we are in the healthcare system right now, we'll all be bankrupt. So we're seeing this as an interim step to a larger goal in 2017 of having the first sensible, affordable healthcare system in the country, where we move from fee-for-service reimbursement to a patient-based payment system and have everybody in, everybody covered, and we all universally pay for it.
Lori also mentioned, though, why is it only mandatory for businesses that have under 50 full-time employees rather than all businesses?
That's the way the feds wrote the bill. Now, listen, I want to be clear. As governor, I didn't write this bill. We simply have the job of implementing it. So it is the way the feds choose to phase this in is in the first 2 years, it's 50 or less, then it jumps up.
It looks like your plan to move to single payer in 2017 may have put the nail in the coffin for the Vermont Health Co-op, which has been denied federal funding. It also didn't pass state muster in terms of being on the exchange in the first place, but they've announced now they're going to fold. And one of the reasons that the federal government cited was because Vermont is moving to single payer. That seems like, you know, like the federal government certainly is paying attention to what Vermont is doing, but do you think that's fair that also may have...
I don't think where Vermont is headed in the future had much to do with CMS's decision about the co-op.
Listen, although they said it.
They said that and a number of other things. What they really said was that Vermont regulators made the right judgment in asking some tough questions about the structure of the company, number one. And number two, the rates. The rates were higher than what MVP in their original filing than in what MVP and Blue Cross were offering. So why would have anyone bought the insurance? Why would you join the co-op if you just asked the question, hey, it looks like mine be more expensive. Why would you go to something that's even more expensive? So the point is there were structural challenges with the co-op's original application. Now, I was supportive of the co-op. I like the idea of cooperatives. I'm a member of Washington Electric here in East Montpelier. You know, these are co-ops have served Vermont well, and the notion of having them as part of the mix where, you know, anything that the insurer makes in effect goes back to reduce premiums for co-op members, I think is a great idea. Now, obviously, as our regulators determined and CMS confirmed, there were problems with the original application. I was hoping that they'd have another chance to resubmit and work this out. CMS has put the nail in the coffin for lots of reasons, very little of which have to do with Vermont's future healthcare plans.
Talking to Governor Peter Shumlin today, listeners, if you have questions for the governor, you can submit them by going to vpr.net and clicking on Vermont Edition, or you can call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Governor Peter Shumlin is my guest today. We've been looking at his upcoming business trip to China, as well as healthcare changes. And we're also going to chat about energy issues, marijuana, and whatever you want to talk about. You can ask the governor a question by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Let's go to Keith calling in from Burlington. Hi, Keith. Go right ahead.
Hi, Jane. Peter.
Hi.
Yeah, I've talked to a number of people who are, frankly, kind of dumbfounded about how you've been talking about moving aggressively away from fossil fuels, and last year you were gung-ho about the fracking ban, but now you're heavily promoting construction of a major fracked gas pipeline through the Champlain Valley and under our lake. Is this just not a case of saying one thing but doing kind of the complete opposite?
You know, I'm sympathetic to the argument you're making, but I would say definitively the answer is no. Listen, there isn't a governor in the country who's pushing harder to get us off our addiction to oil, coal, move to renewables than I am, and we're getting results. We've doubled the number of solar panels in the state since I've been governor. We're going to double them again in the next 2 years, I hope. We're just investing in solar for every single prison in Vermont, along with three other state office buildings. We have a very ambitious energy plan, as you know. 2050 will be 90% renewables. We can get it done. And we're doing everything we can to know how to advance the ball. Now, it's fair for advocates of climate change, which you and I are among, to disagree on some of the ways that we get there. My own view is that right now in Chittenden County, where you're calling from, Keith, you probably have natural gas heating your home. And certainly Chittenden County businesses have natural gas heating their helping to energize their businesses. It's about half the cost, as you know, of oil. But my point is it's much less dirty than burning oil. Now, is it perfect? No. But I feel that for the transition, if we can get Vermonters a much cheaper source of fuel that is less polluting than oil, I'm for it. I think it makes good sense, and I think it'll help grow jobs and economic opportunities all the way down the western side of the state, which is currently transportation challenged. So will there be some frack gas in the gas pipeline that comes down? Probably. Is there natural gas in Vermont right now? Yes. Is it better than dirty oil? You bet. Is it a lot cheaper? Heck yes. I say let's get it done.
Just to keep on this point, because we've got a couple of emails on it as well, Bob posted on our Facebook page saying, though, why import fracked natural gas when Vermont banned the drilling practice itself? Is it just a case of in our borders, we don't want it, but we'll take it from elsewhere?
You can't separate out non-frack gas from frack gas. It's just the reality. Now, listen, I'm not suggesting the argument's not a legitimate one. There will be disagreements among those of us who believe that climate change is the biggest single threat that we face. There'll be disagreements about how we get off of oil and how we get off of fossil fuels. I just think it's good old Vermont common sense that if you can stop burning dirty oil and burn natural gas in the transition 20, 30 years, we can't, unfortunately, just flick the switch and say, okay, no more fossil fuels. That's just not in the real world. And get a great economic benefit while we're doing it. It's a transitionary step that just makes good Vermont common sense. Now, other reasonable people can disagree with me. I get it. That's fair. That's why I love democracy. But I feel that we're making the right decision here, and I hope that we build it.
So what's your plan then for the future when if this is a transitional fuel and a transitional method, how do we then transition from natural gas when we're building these new pipelines that, you know, the companies hope are going to be fruitful to other sources?
There's just no doubt in my mind that because of the economics of natural gas, that it's going to be a part of the energy mix for the short term. What natural gas is allowing us to do in many states is shut down the coal-fired plants that are polluting and destroying Vermont, creating acid rain and climate change and all the other issues. It's also, I believe, going to allow for China and some other countries that are really burning a lot of coal to move from coal once they get into the fracking business, which we all know is ahead. So the question for us as policymakers is, how do we ensure that while we're making a transition to a cleaner fossil fuel, gas over oil and coal, that we continue to have an economy that supports renewables? And that's why I support all of the incentives that help subsidize renewables while we're making this transition off of fossil fuels.
On that note, Rich in Marshfield says, I'm the chair of the Marshfield Energy and Climate Change Committee. We have visited many homes in need of weatherization, but don't have the money to invest in the improvements. Please convey to the governor the need to provide state funding to address this need if we're going to meet the planned 20,000 homes by 2020. We need a levy against fossil fuels to consistently fund the program, similar to the efficiency assessment on electricity.
There's no question that Vermont has, you know, Rich is making a good point, that Vermont's done very, very well, been very innovative in terms of efficiency, using less electricity and therefore wasting less electricity and wasting less money paying for electricity we don't need to use. We've done pretty abysmally when it comes to home heating oil. And as you know, it's a priority of my administration to come up with a better solution to make real progress here. I had some ideas on that last year that didn't get through the legislature, but it's something that we've got to continue to focus on to come up with the funding to ensure that we spend the money now to insulate our homes, replace doors and windows. We have leaking old buildings in Vermont, and just stop wasting resources, whether we're using oil or natural gas to heat those homes.
Do you have a plan to ask the legislature for that money from somewhere specific?
We continue to have conversations with the legislature about the best direction to take there, but I can't tell you I have a specific plan that I'm able to talk about now.
Kevin posted, again, back to the gas pipeline that we've been talking about that'll go through Addison County and then a second build-out later on goes underneath Lake Champlain. And Kevin says, can you comment on the legitimate fears that people have about a natural gas pipeline going under Lake Champlain, which will make it subject to federal jurisdiction, not the state's? Isn't this Vermont Yankee all over again? Now, I don't know really about the jurisdiction of that pipeline under the lake, so maybe you can clarify that, Governor.
You know, with recent advances in boring techniques, my understanding is that if we lay a pipe across New York State, which is going to take one of the big polluters over there, frankly, an oil-burning paper plant, and put it on a cleaner fuel, that we can do that without any adverse impact environmentally on the lake, because the boring now goes so far under the lake that will have no effect on what we're all concerned about, which is life in the lake. So,
but Kevin's concerned about the jurisdiction.
We both have jurisdiction over this issue. Vermont doesn't lose jurisdiction over the questions of the lake. Vermont regulators have jurisdiction over that, as they have jurisdiction over every aspect of the pipeline. We don't cede that as we do in the case of the federal government to the FERC on nuclear energy. There's no equivalent to the FERC.
So your understanding is that both Vermont and New York would have responsibility.
They would have environmental and regulatory responsibility over that. Now, the feds may have some too, but they don't usurp ours, is my understanding, as they do in the case of the FERC. The NRC.
Let's talk a little bit about Vermont Yankee. This was obviously and continues to be big news in the state, the closure of Vermont Yankee. It's going to leave some pretty big financial gaps, though, for Vernon and surrounding communities, as well as for the state budget. We spoke with Representative Michael Hebert right after the announcement that Vermont Yankee was going to be closed, and he expressed some hope that the legislature would provide some relief for Vernon when Vermont Yankee closes down, because there are concerns about the grand list as properties are being sold, concerns about paying the state education taxes. What kind of conversations are you having about what kind of relief, if any, there might be for Vernon?
Well, you know, I just want to be clear. It's not just Vernon. This is obviously a blow to Windham County, as would any job loss. Now, let's talk about the jobs and the loss a little bit, because it's different than, a big plant that has 650 employees just shutting down. When a nuclear power plant shuts down, it takes 5 or 6 years for it to cool off before you can even touch it. Now, you don't just walk away. It takes roughly half of the employees to run that plant during the cooling off period. So obviously it's my hope to work together with Entergy and others to hope that of those 50% employees, most of them are people that are currently working there that can continue to work there. Then you have a period of time, a debate about when decommissioning starts. I want to begin decommissioning as quickly as we possibly can. We'll be working together with all our federal partners as well as Entergy to try to get that done. And obviously there's a lot of jobs while the decommissioning is happening.
It sounds like the jobs during actual decommissioning, what we heard from the NRC last week when we did a program on decommissioning, was that the actual process of decommissioning, those jobs are highly specialized, not necessarily jobs that current Vermont Yankee employees are trained to do many cases.
That's correct. It's a different set of skills. My only point being, when we're talking about Windham County and jobs, if you start spending $600 million to $1 billion decommissioning a plant, obviously there's a lot of jobs there. And you're right, different set of skills, but lots of jobs.
So even if the people are coming in from out of state, you mean they may be spending money in the area? Because it doesn't sound like it's necessarily going to be current Vermont Yankee employees doing that work.
Yeah, you might be surprised to know that a lot of Vermont Yankee's ancillary economic impact on Windham County is already paying outsiders to come in. When we refuel, for example, it fills up our hotels and restaurants. Obviously, it's outside contractors that come in and do that work. Then they leave. So Windham County's used to that phenomenon. But let's forget where they live or where they come from. The fact is you're talking about jobs. Now, having said that, Windham County was hurting in terms of jobs and economic development before this happened, and this isn't going to help the cause. So we are working together with legislators, with the folks in Windham County, to come up with a package that will help Windham County in this transition, and we'll certainly have it by when the legislature gets going.
Can you give us any specifics about what might be in that package?
It would be premature. We're working very closely, as you probably know. The Speaker, myself, the Senate President, and others set up a process for this. We have a committee working on this in Windham County, have been working thoughtfully on this, have already, as you know, issued a report on what the impacts would be. And we're working closely with them to say to them, hey, what would really make the difference here? Then we're really going to scrutinize those requests and try find ways to help. We're not just going to leave Windham County out there saying, hey, you know, we can't help you.
More broadly speaking, Dagsteel posted, how do you propose to replace the high-paying jobs being lost at IBM and Vermont Yankee as they downsize or close?
Wow. Well, let's first start with IBM. Obviously, IBM did do some layoffs that we're all familiar with, but IBM is strong. They're making money in Vermont. They're going to continue to grow, and you'll see contractions and expansions, as you've always seen at IBM over the years. But I have no anticipation or belief that IBM doesn't continue to have a significant role in Vermont. They're a great employer. They're our biggest employer. We have a great relationship with them. I had great meetings with IBM executives just 2 weeks ago, and we're working together on a lot of exciting projects. So to put them in the same category as VY, I would just argue that we're talking about a different kettle of fish.
Would you hang your hat on that? We've talked to analysts who say, look, IBM is using legacy technology. You know, some certain analysts say there is not a place for IBM, it looks like, in the future. You categorically say you don't agree with that.
You know, as long as IBM has been in Vermont, there have been folks, analysts and everything else who have, you know, said, oh, wow, they're never going to make the next transition. The fact of the matter is that Essex Junction plant is incredibly innovative. They've always beat the odds. They went through a huge transition that we sometimes forget when Big Blue went to each individual plant or an entity having to make money on their own. And IBM made that transition, you know, 10, 12 years ago and did so with extraordinary. Now you can't buy a chip or a phone or anything anywhere, not IBM products, but any product of electronics anywhere in the world without at least two or three or four or five or nine of those chips coming out of Essex Junction here in Vermont. So the point is IBM's a survivor. They're smart. They're innovative. And I know that they're going to continue to have an important presence in this great state. Having said that, VY is a different kettle of fish. It really is. But we always knew, to be candid, that when we built the plant, and I was born and raised in Windham County, I lived there all my life, it is no surprise to any of us that in 2012, when the design of the plant was over, that at some point it was going to come to an end. No one thought VY was going to run for 600 years, as we hope IBM will. So we're really talking about two very different circumstances. Now, our job now is to make sure that we find ways to get the hard-working employees at VY great jobs, hopefully right here in Vermont. And we're working hard to help them with that transition for those that aren't going to continue to work there for the next 5 or 6 years.
Got to take a quick break. Then we'll come back with more with Governor Peter Shumlin. If you have questions, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or post your questions on the Facebook page of Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today, Governor Peter Shumlin is answering questions on a whole host of issues, from foreign investment to Vermont Yankee shutdown implications to where we draw the line on military installations. If you have a question for him, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Governor, I want to move away from the Vermont Yankee issue, but just very quickly before we do, I want to ask you about this issue of the generation tax that currently Entergy pays the state for the generation of power. We're getting about $11 to $12 million a year. That goes away when Vermont Yankee shuts down. The legislature increased that generation tax in 2012. It looked like partly, again, to put more pressure on Entergy as we were trying to close it down. as far as I can see, that's money that's going into the general fund and we're using it. Given that the legislature and you were both hoping Vermont Yankee would shut down, why didn't we have a better contingency plan for the gap that would be caused when we lose that generation tax?
Well, let me just back up. We didn't increase the overall dollars that we asked for from Entergy, and there was no attempt to try to raise taxes to drive them out of Vermont. In fact, we raised all we did was consolidate the money they were paying in. I won't get into the weeds because we're out of time, but consolidate the money that they were paying into one single source instead of having different sources feeding helping to support Vermont. So we didn't raise the revenue taken from Entergy. We consolidated into one simple tax, and it made a lot of sense.
Although not to Entergy, which has been suing over that generation
tax. Sure, but
I'm
confident they're not going to win those suits. Having said that, we all knew that eventually Entergy is going to stop generating juice, and that there's a revenue hole there, obviously, but we always knew that was coming. The question for us now as policymakers is, how do we make sure that Vermont gets adequately compensated for being a high-level nuclear waste storage area when we were promised when the plant was built that we wouldn't have any high-level nuclear waste stored on the banks of the Connecticut River here in the state of Vermont? So obviously, we know the generating tax was going to end whenever Entergy stopped generating, but I would not suggest that that's the end of Vermont's revenue needs when, in fact, I believe we deserve compensation for obviously storing high-level nuclear waste as long as it's going to sit on the banks of the Connecticut River, which I don't believe is the best place to keep it.
Are you saying that you think we can replace that generation tax with some other tax on nuclear waste storage?
I'm just saying that we all knew when it stopped generating juice that as any electric generating facility in Vermont, it would no longer pay a generating tax.
Now the legislature is saying we need to find a way to plug that gap. It doesn't sound like we had a plan
for
it.
Well, I haven't heard them say that.
It's in news reports. We need to find a way to plug the gap for that $12 million that is going to go away, that generation tax.
Well, there's a difference between saying we need to find a way to plug the gap and saying Entergy should pay it. There isn't a legislator that when generating – every electric generating facility in Vermont pays a generating tax. When it stops generating juice, obviously, it stops paying the tax. The question for us as policymakers now is there an appropriate compensation to Vermonters for storing high-level nuclear waste here that we weren't promised? And that's something we'll be looking at.
And it sounds – just the way you're putting those together, it sounds like that's your plan for that $12 million hole.
I'm just saying that we're – no.
Because otherwise, what is the plan for
the
$12 million hole?
As you know, revenues go up and down in all of our sources of income in Vermont. Sometimes income tax does well. Sometimes the sales does. Sometimes it doesn't. We just have to plug a hole in the transportation budget. $12 million is a small part of Vermont's overall over $5 billion budget. So this is something we can cope with. However, when you ask me the question about the generating tax – are we giving up all revenue from Entergy? I would argue that that's a question we need to look at given the fact that Vermont's now going to be a high-level waste storage area, which is something we were promised would not happen.
I want to move on to some other issues that listeners are bringing up. We got a note from Eileen in Winooski who says, it appears that the low-hanging pork prize of the federally funded missile site in Jericho would be less environmentally damaging, have less negative impact on residents' health, quality of life, and property values, and would bring more jobs than the proposed F-35 basing opposed by many Vermonters. Eileen says they both have been called necessary for national security and both have been a tremendous waste of taxpayer dollars for ill-performing programs. How does Governor Shumlin explain his support of the F-35 and not of the missile site?
Well, you know, I'm not an expert on a missile site, and I don't want to – you know, I usually try not to talk about things that I know nothing about. And obviously, as governor of Vermont, I don't oversee the missile system that's been proposed first by President Reagan, I believe, and then all the way through the other presidents. I think it's a little bit of a pipe dream. I know Senator Leahy and others feel strongly that it's just a lot of money being wasted and that it'll never really happen, or if it does happen, it won't work. Having said that, so I'm not going to comment too much on the jobs. I don't know a thing about it. And I'll leave that to the discretion of our extraordinary congressional delegation, the best in the country, Senator Leahy, Senator Sanders, and Congressman Welch.
Why not inform yourself then and make a decision based on what you know?
Because there are some areas where I feel that the congressional delegation who oversees the Pentagon should make the decisions. Obviously, I don't have any impact on their budgets or what they do. Having said that, on the F-35s, I understand what we're being asked there. We're being asked to not go to the next generation of equipment that everyone in the military will be using. And it just seems to be good old common sense that when we moved from the old fighter jets to the F-16s, we didn't say, hey, let's not use them. We said, let's bring them on. And so obviously the question there is a very different question. Does our National Guard, our Air Guard, continue to have the equipment that it needs to be the best Air Guard in the country? And I want to keep that happening because I think, first of all, it's very important to us. It's important for jobs. And most importantly, I'm very proud of our Air Guard in Vermont. And I think it's an important contribution that we make to the military stability of the country.
And you want us to be first. I mean, that if you're saying everybody's going to get those F-35s eventually, what you're saying is you want Vermont to be first. That's the question at hand.
I don't think it's a question of first or second. The F-16s are being phased out. They're being replaced by the F-35s. If you don't take the next generation of equipment, you're going to have an obsolete Air Guard, period. It's just this is not gray. This is one of those black or white decisions. And I personally believe that having Vermont's Air Guard with the most modern equipment is really important for Vermont.
Let's go to Koso, who's calling in from Danville and has been waiting on the line. Hi, Koso. Go right ahead.
Yes, I'd like to see an embodied energy tax on food in Vermont. The current cost of like agribusiness food in supermarkets doesn't reflect the true cost, as in destruction of topsoil, pollution from fertilizers, decreased nutrition, greenhouse gases from transportation. And this tax would go directly back to people in a food stand, three squares meal. But the prime objective would be to give a level economic playing field to the local organic farmers.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks for the call. Just to try to be brief, I'm not a supporter of taxing food. Right now, the sales tax exempts food. And I think that's important because obviously, regardless of income, everyone needs to eat. And so I've never supported taxing food. I do support, though, your overall message, which is that we should do everything we can in Vermont to promote farmers markets, food to plate, farm to fork, make sure that we're consuming the extraordinary food that Vermont farmers and producers are making. And I would argue we're leading the country there. We've made great investments with my Secretary of Agriculture, Chuck Ross, and others, partnership to help grow that sector of our economy. And we're making great strides. I don't think we necessarily need a food tax to make that happen.
What about a marijuana tax? You've said in recent weeks that you are in favor of legalizing marijuana, although you've said you want to take it slow, but not too slow. Is this about taxation for you?
You know, it's about a sane drug policy for the United States and for Vermont. Listen, I'm grateful that Colorado and Washington State get to go first on this one. There are going to be some challenges ahead as you move from a state that has obviously not legalized to how they legalize and tax marijuana. And I'm not anxious to be at the front of the line on this one. At the same time, I'm a firm believer that our current drug policies are pretty messed up in this country. And frankly, we share some of that concern in Vermont. Just this morning, we did another major drug bust up in St. Albans. I can tell you that heroin and other opiates are ravaging our communities, ravaging families, driving crime in Vermont. We've got an epidemic of opiate addiction in this country, starting often with OxyContin, FDA-approved drugs, and then moving to other regulated drugs, and it's a real challenge for us. So I would like to see us spend our resources there and not on small amounts of marijuana.
Do you think a tax on marijuana could be used then to invest in dealing with other substance abuse issues?
Well, you know, let's see what Washington State and Colorado come up with there. It's going to be interesting to see how much revenue they actually get from it, what problems they have. As I said, this is not a top priority of mine. I just assume let Colorado and Washington feel their way on this one.
For how long?
Well, I don't know. Let's see. But I don't, you know, I just assume be the leaders on marriage equality and things that make a difference in the lives of Vermonters, and let the other two states try to ferret out this one with the federal government.
Before we let you go, while we're talking here about Colorado, which legalized marijuana, Colorado obviously dealing with some pretty severe flooding issues right now. And you have sent, at the request of John Hickenlooper, the governor there, some of our Agency of Transportation officials who were very involved in dealing with Tropical Storm Irene issues. What do you expect them to do to help the state of Colorado?
Well, we sent two of our leading engineers out to help them get give them advice on how to get bridges and roads up and running on a temporary basis, and then the challenge of rebuilding. We have Sue Minner out there, our Deputy Secretary of Transportation, and my recovery officer for Irene, working together with the governor, with his chief of staff, with AOT, to try share the awful lessons that we learned from Irene with Colorado, because they're going through many of the same challenges. I've had great conversations with Governor Hickenlooper. We're good friends. I offered help. He accepted it. And I think having some of Vermont's experience out there will help him get Colorado back on its feet faster than they otherwise would have.
Governor Peter Shumlin, thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate it. Hope you'll let us know what happens on the trip to China.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
And that will do it for today's show. Tomorrow, toga parties, beer pong, keggers. Alcohol almost seems like an expected part of the college years. In fact, nearly half of American college students engage in high-risk drinking. But many universities are trying to change that. 32 schools, including UVM, just completed a year-long learning collaborative on college drinking. We're going to find out what they learned, so you can send your comments or questions about college drinking to vermontedition@vpr.net. Our program is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson. Peter Biello directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.